Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Being top editor of the New York Times is no job for the weak need. Not ever, and definitely not now. The news business is in epic turmoil. Newspapers are in deep trouble. The way to digital recreation is still unclear. And a new generation of politicians is pouring wrath on what Sarah Palin likes to call the lamestream media. What's it like to steer the gray lady, the New York Times, through all that? Today we'll ask this hour On Point executive editor of the New York Times, Bill Keller, on the future of the news business. You can join the conversation. Is the Times your go-to ultimate news source? Is it your political whipping boy? Will newspapers survive? And what would we do, what would we be without them? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is Bill Keller, executive editor of the New York Times, the chief, the boss. He's been at the Times for 26 years, reporter, foreign correspondent in Moscow and South Africa, columnist, newsroom boss, was named executive editor, top dog in 2003, in the teeth of a storm of change. Bill Keller, it is great to have you. Welcome to On Point.
Thanks, Tom. It's nice to be here.
Boy, you got this job at an interesting time. When you were in the biz, you know, starting out, did you ever imagine, I mean, first of all, being top editor at the New York Times, but being top editor when everything was changing like this, could you have imagined?
I never even imagined being an editor. In fact, I spent the first 25 years of my life in newspapers swearing I'd never become an editor. Who would want to give up the fun of being a reporter for that, you know, bag of responsibilities? So, no, I didn't see any of this coming, I don't think. Although, you know, on the other hand, change is pretty much a constant in the business we're in. And that didn't begin with the Internet.
Didn't begin then, but maybe more velocity there than at any time. What's it like to have that bag of change in your lap now? Can you concentrate on the news, or are you always in meetings, you know, down the hall with the business side about how to reshape the news delivery to survive?
Well, there's a lot more of the latter than there was when I initially got this job 7+ years ago. I do manage to focus a good bit of my attention on the news. But you know, last year, for example, we spent much of the year discussing the very fundamental question of whether we should begin charging for our content on the website. And, you know, I felt then and feel now that it was very important, although that's a business decision, that the journalists, that the newsroom have a seat at that table and a voice in that conversation. And we did. So it meant I spent a lot of time sitting around conference tables discussing issues that not traditionally part of the job description of a newspaper editor.
You know, the conventional wisdom has been that you can't charge for information online, not much for news anyway. Where did you come down on the question for the Times? You tried a bit before and it went away. You know, what's the Bill Keller position for on charging for news online?
Well, I started out with my head and heart in sort of different places. My heart said, you know, we should charge for this. First of all, because what we produce is qualitatively different from the sort of flood of small bits of information out there on the internet. I mean, there's a real effort and labor and craft that goes into what we do, and it costs money to produce it. Mm-hmm. That's how you demonstrate your worth in the marketplace, is you put a price on it. In my head was more in the place that you described, that you know there is not a tradition of charging for information on the web, but the tradition isn't very long. And video companies and music companies have demonstrated, you know, if you give some people something of value, something that's not easily replicated elsewhere, give it to them digitally and set the price at the right place, they will pay for it. And I basically brought my head into line with my heart, and I believe if the pay model is carefully designed, it ought to work.
So remind us, where has the New York Times come down? What are you going to start charging for, what and when, Bill?
Well, a lot of those details are still being worked out. There are committees within committees, you know, working out everything from the software development to the pricing and so on. Basically, what we plan to adopt next year is a metered model. And that means that you get a certain amount for free, and then you hit a gate that says, if you want to go beyond this point, we'd like you to pay a subscription. Most of the traffic to the Times website will not encounter that pay sign. People who just come to look at the homepage, people who come from through search engines or from links to other places, the sort of casual browsers at our website will probably not encounter any kind of a pay toll gate. And that's by design, because we want to keep the traffic large, and we have the largest newspaper website in the world.
But the meter will be running, and once you hit a certain amount of usage...
Of a certain kind. Basically, the way to understand this, I think, is if you use the New York Times as your newspaper online, if you're there all the time, if you're reading a lot, if it's your go-to place, then yes, you should pay a, as yet to be determined, but modest subscription fee every month for the privilege and to keep it going. And I think people will be willing to do that. But we don't want to, set that bar too close to the front, because we don't want to lose the traffic that advertisers depend on. And advertisers pay us a lot online for our audience.
We'll talk about that and how the business model works, if it works, with online advertising. Your publisher, Arthur Sulzberger, said earlier this month in London that we will stop printing the New York Times sometime in the future. Date TBD, to be determined. In other words, stop printing the paper version thereof. Do you agree? And like when?
Well, it all hinges on that date TBD.
Yeah.
I would place a rather large bet, if I had a lot of money, on the likelihood that the Times will be a newspaper in print 10 years from now, probably 20 years from now. At some point, it may go away altogether, or it may become a kind of boutique product. They still sell vinyl records, for people who are aficionados. And there may be a sort of hardcore of people who like the experience of reading a printed newspaper, but into the foreseeable future. I think we are, and it's also possible that it just won't be a sustainable business model at some point to print on newsprint. But I believe that day is a long way off. We have a very loyal base of people who like the newspaper in print and are willing to pay a hefty price for it. A lot of those people, by the way, are not geriatric. They're young. Mm. Our audience is a good deal younger than you would think. I expect in my lifetime that there will be a New York Times in print. And beyond the point when there's a New York Times in print, whenever that might be, there will be a New York Times.
The print newspaper business has been a rough and tumble competitive business for a long time. The New York Times was, in many ways, unchallenged for a good stretch. Now the Wall Street Journal is coming at you guys hammer and tongs very explicitly since Rupert Murdoch bought it. Coming weekend, they're rolling out a new weekend edition with book reviews and lifestyle reporting. They're doing more New York reporting. Their editor over there, Robert Thompson, says there's no contest nationally. Now we're more than twice as big as the New York Times. They're not a serious competitor. He says of your paper, Bill, what do you say?
Well, Mr. Thompson says a lot of things.
Yes.
First, just to get this, numbers thing in perspective, what's the old line about lies, damn lies, and statistics? I mean, the Journal has a larger circulation count as counted by the industry agency that does these official counts called the Audit Bureau of Circulation.
2 million copies on weekends versus 900,000 for the Times.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. And the reason, that number is accurate. That number includes paid online subscriptions, which the Journal has had for a long time. Before Rupert Murdoch arrived, mm-hmm. the Journal has charged a lot of people, a fair number of whom I think because they're in business and need to read the business coverage, put it on their expense accounts. And every one of those online subscriptions counts as a subscription. Next year, when we start charging for online content, we'll be able to count our online subscriptions too, and then it'll be apples and apples.
Mm-hmm.
But I just as long as we're wallowing in the realm of numbers, I mean, Rupert Murdoch likes to say that we are now in the era where what really counts is online readership. Well, our online readership, depending on which metric you use, is somewhere between 20 million and 30 million people. And the Journal's readership online is a fraction of that. So you know, I feel fine about our competitive posture with the journal.
So bring it on online. What do you think of the imprint of Rupert Murdoch since he's gotten so deep into the American news business? What's the effect, the Murdoch effect, on news and news coverage in this country?
It's a good question and an important question, and you know, one that I probably view from a slightly jaundiced position, since, you know, it's not just that we compete with him, but he owns, you know, Fox News, which takes a particular delight in skewering the New York Times. There are several of the kind of shouting heads on talk news who would be at a loss for words if they didn't have the New York Times to kick around. You know, he owns the New York Post, which is, you know, a delightfully rowdy and unreliable tabloid sheet, which also delights in poking at the New York Times. And, you know, I think you have to separate his impact in those media from his impact on, I don't know what his impact is and will be via the Wall Street Journal. That's still an evolving publication. His major impact in American media, I think, has been Fox News. Again, you have to not count his movie studios, which is where the money comes from. You know, Avatar probably made more money than all of his other properties put together. But his main impact on American public life, I would say, is Fox News. And that impact has been to introduce a level of cynicism into the public debate, I believe.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with New York Times executive editor Bill Keller, the top editor at the Times, the boss, the chief, about the New York Times and the future of the American news media. It's great to have him with us. Bill was talking about Fox and politicians, for that matter. They really go at the Times. Here's Bill O'Reilly, March 12th of this year.
Standards of fairness of the New York Times and other liberal media organizations? Come on. Right now, liberal columnists at the New York Times outnumber conservatives 10 to 1 throughout the newspaper. That sounds fair, doesn't it?
There's O'Reilly. Here's Fox News' Sean Hannity. And late last year, talking about accusing the Times of leaning too far left.
So is the New York Times and other liberal media outlets responsible for pushing an atheist agenda? Joining me now is the author of the New York Times bestseller, A Slobbering Love Affair, the true pathetic story of the torrid romance between Barack Obama and the mainstream media. I still laugh at the title. Bernie Goldberg is with us. Bernie, good to see you.
Ha ha, it's funny. And Sarah Palin out on the stump, Searchlight Nevada. Here she is lambasting what she calls the lamestream media.
Don't get sucked into the lamestream media's lies about conservative America's standing up for freedom as inciting violence. Violence isn't the answer. It's a bunch of bunk what the media is trying to feed you. Don't let them divert attention from the debate.
There's the attack. The top editor, Bill Keller, is with us. Listeners, Catherine in Waltham, Massachusetts. Catherine, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks. No, I just want to make a comment, and I'll get off and listen to any feedback from it. My husband actually listens sometimes to some of the Fox people, and it infuriates me that anyone can think that those sources are reliable. We get the New York Times every day as well, and I noticed that when my daughter wrote her master's thesis on national security affairs subject that the New York Times is considered a reliable source to quote, and you sure couldn't say the same for, you know, the Washington Post or any of those other sources. I just think the New York Times is the standard, and it's just amazing to me that Fox decides to take it on. I don't understand that at all.
Catherine, thanks for your call. Bill Keller, why do you think the New York Times has become a target of so much vitriol from the right? Why?
Well, you know, Glenn Beck, who's another one of the Fox talking heads who likes to come after the Times, described himself as a rodeo clown once upon a time, and which I think was an interesting kind of burst of candor. I think they do it because it's entertaining. It's particularly entertaining to people who feel angry and abused and neglected by the government, who feel that they haven't gotten a fair shake. I think most of the audience for that kind of vitriol doesn't read the New York Times. What they know about the New York Times is what they hear from its from its critics. For the most part, I find, you know, that when you engage with somebody who is a regular reader of the paper, you know, that they get what we're trying to do. Not that we're perfect, but that there's a real ambition and a real effort to be fair and to be impartial and to get things right, and a real sense of that it's our responsibility to correct it if we don't.
Do you see overall in the American news media, and now that sprawl's just as wide as can be, I'm not even sure where the boundaries are anymore, do you see a fall off in those efforts, fair, impartial, get it right, in reliability, and do you see an impact on American cultural, political discourse, Bill, if that's the case?
It's not so much that there's been a fall off in serious, you know, responsible journalism, although there has been some of that just because of the economic erosion that's hit the business. But the balance has shifted because, you know, there used to be the old joke that freedom of the press belongs to the man who owns one. Well, now freedom of the press belongs to anybody with a, you know, an internet service provider. You know, it's the world has been, that world has been democratized in a way that, in, you know, is good. But it also means that people who, you know, can take to the internet without actual information, without a reporting staff to tell them what's going on, and without the need for any of that. And so the balance has shifted more towards polemic, more towards noise, more towards heat. And it does worry me. It also is, we now live in a world where because you can select your news diet, mm-hmm. it's entirely possible to put together a kind of diet of information from sources that will confirm all of your prejudices. So you can feel like a well-informed person without ever encountering an argument that challenges your prejudices.
Where does that turn around, and when does it turn around, Bill? You've seen the trouble that all kinds of newspapers are in. New York Times itself, third quarter, you know, a financial report yesterday, loss, lower revenue, and it's hardly the first time. There's been a lot of that. When does this turn around, or does it turn around? Do we just have a smaller traditional news media business in this country?
I guess I should preface my answer by telling you that I'm an innate optimist, and some occasionally verge on being a Pollyanna. But I think the future landscape of news media includes, in addition to a lot of kind of, you know, small voices sort of shouting into the void, it will include a mix of survivors and startups. There will be survivors. The New York Times, I'm quite confident, will be one of them. There will be other major, you know, the Wall Street Journal will probably be a survivor. NPR will be a survivor. There will be, you know, serious mainstream news organizations that will, they'll adapt, but they will survive. And then there will be serious, well-intentioned startups. You're seeing a number of them. Some of them we actually have partnerships with. There's a news cooperative in the San Francisco Bay Area. There's one in Chicago that are strictly online, although we provide them a couple of pages in the New York Times for a print edition in their local communities. There's a place called The Voice of San Diego. There's an outfit called Global Post, which hires freelance reporters around the world. You know, a number of those organizations, those startups will succeed and grow. And so I believe there will be a serious, high-minded media, in part because there's a demand for it.
Serious
and high-minded.
There really
is an appetite for it.
But how substantial, Bill? Will it be enough to keep track of what's going on in this country? You know, in the government side, the watchdog role, the corporate watchdog role, the cultural role, will there be enough of it, the adequate resources to cover this democracy so that citizens really know what's going on?
Oh, dear. I hope so. I mean, some of the things that have grown up, these new ventures, these startups, are very much focused on exactly that mission, the accountability mission.
But they're tiny.
For example, they are tiny, but they're growing, and they're figuring it out. You know, that we're going to go through a period when things, you know, we are going through a period when things are tough for news organizations as ambitious as ours, you know, places that deploy foreign correspondents and investigative reporters. And there has definitely been a decline in both of those things, the number of news organizations that keep bureaus going overseas and that have the time for really deep investigative accountability reporting. That there's no question that that has suffered a great deal of damage in the last few years. But there's still a lot to hang on to, and I think it will rebound.
Robert, in Connecticut, you're on the air with Bill Keller.
Thank you. I grew up in a newspaper family. We had my stepfather was an editor, and we had the Current.
Sure.
And the Times every morning. And then I was on the West Coast for 40 years as a public official and watched the news press, Santa Barbara News Press, melt down. My point is that the civil discourse of the Times is essential, and I support them. Thank you.
Great. We'll take that. Let's go to get one more right here.
I'll take that happily.
I'll take it. Liz in Worcester, Massachusetts, calling in from Worcester. Liz, you're on the air with Bill Keller.
Thank you. I have a comment and a question. I grew up in the 50s and 70s in New York, where when I got on the Long Island Railroad every morning, it was the sea of the New York Times folded in half with everyone completely hypnotized by reading it. I also had a mother who was not college educated but read every book on the New York Times bestsellers list, because that was how the cultural conversation and the social conversation that everyone could share. And I think the Times missed something when they had to take children's books and how-to books and cookbooks off the bestsellers list and separate them out, because that was saying something about what was happening in our culture. But I say that because at the same time, I am really worried about we do not have a cultural conversation any longer that is intelligent, informed, uplifting, amplified, to create, I think, a serious conversation, and that the print journalists do that. So my question in some ways is, when you're sitting around with your, you know, plans for the future groups, why do we need the New York Times? I could see why we needed the New York Times when I was a young person. Why do we need the New York Times? And I will say there are lessons from other print to internet, industries. And I mention this because I'm a physician, and when I was a medical student, you went to the library to look up every journal article. You read the New England Journal because it came in the mail, and I never do that anymore.
But Liz, you seem to sort of answer your own question. Why do we need it? You said you want, you know, serious, fair, impartial, uplifting. Isn't that what you want?
That they are not conveying to the public that we need it. I mean, my mother read the books on the New York Times because she needed to be doing that to be part of a larger conversation. I think that a lot of younger people do not think they need the New York Times anymore. I think that if they don't understand the need for serious investigative reporting.
Liz, we've got it. Bill Keller, what do you say to that? People maybe just don't understand. There's going to be others who, and we heard them already, who throw brickbats at the New York Times. Liz is saying maybe people don't understand the things that it does, needs to do.
I think there's some truth in that, and it's a sad truth. And some of it is generational, I suppose. I mean, you know, we normally, the people who are calling in on your show who've read the New York Times since they were 12 years old are sort of the exception. It's generally, mm-hmm. you know, when they get into their 20s and out of college or at least into college that people start picking up a serious newspaper habit. Some of it is atmospheric. I mean, there are just so many people out there. You know, I talked earlier about the cynicism in our social discourse, and I find that very worrisome. There is so much just loud, non-fact-based noise in the atmosphere that it not only distracts people, but it convinces them that you really can't believe anything. You know, they're all just making it up.
All the same.
It's all the same. You know, mm-hmm. some of them are liberal, some of them are conservative, but they're all just the same. And, you know, all we can do to respond to that, all I know how to do, is to keep offering people the best we can do. You know, journalism that comes from reporters who are actually there and witnessed things and editors who, you know, go out of their way to make sure that the reports are comprehensible and accurate and fair, and investigative reporting that, spares no one, regardless of their party. I do think, again, there are 20 or 30 million people who come to us regularly on the website, and then there's a still quite handsomely profitable print circulation of the New York Times. And so there is clearly a demand. There are some people who recognize that this is important.
Let's go to Walt in Hingham, Massachusetts. Walt, you're on the air with Bill Keller.
Thanks, Tom. So I consider myself an independent, and in order to keep track of the election, especially now it's coming up in about a month, I like to get an unbiased version of what's going on. And we actually get the New York Times delivered to our house. And since I'm busy, I usually only get time to look at the front page. And usually whenever I do, I get a little disappointed because it seems like it's mainly not bashing the conservatives, but it's not making them look good. And that usually makes the liberals look good. So I'm wondering if that happens on purpose or if that just is the way that our country is moving. So I was just wondering, as editor, do you weed the stories out that make the conservatives look good, or is there just something in our culture that's we're moving more liberal?
Walt, let us pick it up. Bill Keller, what do you say? Walt looks like he's not bashing conservatives, but something like it.
Well, to some extent, we bash everybody. I mean, I think I can give you a long list of Democratic politicians who don't believe that the Times has gone soft on them. You know, we have this. We have a job at the New York Times called the public editor, which was invented about the time I started my job. We're on our fourth one, and it's a sort of ombudsman who, answers reader complaints and tries to address them in a column in the Sunday paper. And the first of those public editors, Dan Okrent, wrote a column once, and the headline on the column was "Is the New York Times liberal?" And the first sentence of his answer was, "Of course it is," and I've been haunted by that ever since, because most of the people who quote it back to me never bothered to read the rest of the column. They only read the headline and the first sentence.
What did it mean then?
What he meant by that was not that we were, in the tank for any party or group of politicians, not that we were that we had a liberal agenda. What he meant was that we were liberal kind of in the sense that a liberal arts college is liberal. That is, we're based in a big city, our orientation is more urban. That tends to mean, more freewheeling, more open-minded, if you will. We cover gay unions along on our weddings page. We don't when we write about evolution, we don't feel like we have to give equal time to creationism. We are, tolerant or try to be. And in that sense, I think we're liberal in the sense of having a political agenda or a loyalty or leaning. We work extremely hard not to be.
Does that mean, though, that you're not a paper for conservatives?
I don't think we're a paper for liberals or for conservatives. I hope we're a paper for everybody. And what we strive for, and I'm not going to claim that we always succeed. Newspapers are put out by human beings, and they try as we do to edit them, they have their opinions. But we try very hard to write a paper where conservatives recognize themselves in what we write.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Bill Keller, executive editor of the New York Times, the top editor at the Times, the editorial chief, looking at the New York Times, its news coverage, and the future of the American news media. Bill joins us from New York. We've got a caller from Nashville, Tennessee. Brendan, you're on the air with Bill Keller.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just had a question about, obviously there's a big dust-up with the reporting of Judith Miller. Regardless of one's perspective, at the end of the day, there was a lot of questions about it leading up to the Iraq War, and some other journalists in various publications. And I'm just wondering how that impacted the New York Times and if it has changed some various aspects of reporting.
It's been a fraught time. Judith Miller was a big, big case, of course, what she knew, who told her, and whether or not she'd give it up. The Times reporting on warrantless wiretapping. Bill, what did you learn from the Judith Miller case, first of all?
Well, it was one of the first things that I had to deal with when I got this job.
Right. Hello. Welcome to the roller derby.
Right. Welcome to the roller derby. And it was, you know, and the question at the time was really, you know, mainly focused on her reporting about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
And early on in this job, I went back and read not just her coverage, but everything the Times wrote on that subject. Eventually,
whether she was too close to her sources, whether she had delivered their line too uncritically.
Right. Those were the questions that mm-hmm. were out there. And in the end, it was really not just a question about Judy Miller. It was a question about the Times and its coverage and whether it was overly credulous in that period after September 11th when the country felt this surge of patriotism, whether we had sort of let that get away with us. And I ended up writing a kind of mea culpa for the newspaper mm-hmm. in which I said that we had published, you know, a number of stories that were overly unskeptical of the information. To some extent, that's been exaggerated. We also wrote some pretty good stories. On the whole, I think we let down our guard, let down our readers in our role as kind of accountability holders, if you will.
Why do you think that happened? Was it something to do with the political tenor of the Times? Was it to do with the Times? Was the Times cowed?
I think it was a little bit of falling into the worst trap in journalism, which is getting caught up in the conventional wisdom. Because remember, at that time, everybody, almost everybody, thought that Saddam Hussein had or probably had or was close to having some kind of weapons of mass destruction. He'd used chemical weapons, you know, before. He had shown a serious interest in developing a nuclear program at one time.
But that gap, word, is exactly what the news business is supposed to nail down, isn't it?
Exactly right. Exactly right. So I think to some extent, the news media in general and the Times in particular got swept up in the conventional wisdom. And some of it was other sort of smaller-minded things. You know, we are in a competitive business, and government officials who know that will leak you a piece of information that happens to serve their cause. And sometimes, you know, reporters go overboard in their yearning to have a front-page exclusive to the extent that they don't spend enough time ascertaining whether that front-page exclusive is true or trustworthy. So it was a combination of factors, and some of it probably was this sort of sense of patriotism in the country. It was a hard time to sound too skeptical about what the president was saying.
There's another story from that handful of years that still has a question mark around it in a way. Of course, the big reporting done by James Risen and Eric Lichtblau on the Bush administration's warrantless wiretapping, eavesdropping, and the Times sat on that. It came out in December of 2005, and questions have remained about, you know, would the 2004 presidential election have gone differently? Would George W. Bush have been reelected if the whole country had known what was going on with warrantless wiretapping? In your decision to hold it, did you hold it because the elections were there and you didn't want to influence them, or was there some other reason?
No. I mean, first of all, our policy on stories is we publish them when they're ready. When we feel confident the information, when the subjects of the stories have had a fair opportunity to respond, we publish them. And if that's the day before an election, fine. If it's a month after the election, that's also fine. In fact, in the 2004 elections, a few days before the election, we published an extremely damning story about the American failure to secure a repository of very high-powered explosives during the invasion in Iraq. And there was some question about what that repository was looted. There was some question about whether those explosives were now destined to be used against Americans. It was a major screw-up And we published that a few days before the election, got attacked by supporters of the Bush White House for trying to influence the election. And in neither case were we trying to influence the election, except to the extent that if you've got a story and it's and it's nailed down and everybody's had a chance to respond, voters are entitled to have that information in a timely fashion. No, my reasons for sitting on that, if it was about the election, I wouldn't have sat on it for a full year.
That's a long time.
That was a long time. No, I had a lot of reasons for sitting on it, but they basically added up to doubts about some aspects of the story and a conviction that there was something to the administration's argument that publishing the information would put lives at risk.
Let's go to Augusta, Georgia, and Gary. Gary, you're on with Bill Keller.
Hi. Thank you very much. Appreciate your conversation. Just a comment. I'm part of, I guess, a large group of people that live a fast-paced life. I enjoy getting news, but not interested in stuff that newspapers have a lot of stuff that I really don't need. I like headlines, and so I go online. I hit Google, Yahoo, and do their news search. I click a button, I get all my national news headlines. I click another button, I get all my world news headlines, or another one, and I get sports. And it's not just one article. I can read Fox opinions, or I can read Times opinions, and CNN. I can even read Al Jazeera opinions on certain issues.
Yep.
Get video clips and see video interviews. And just get, I could have all the news that I need for my day in 15 minutes rather than having to thumb through a bulky newspaper where I read part of an article and then I got to flip to section D44 to read the rest
right.
of
it. Gary, let me ask you, do you pay for any of that news, that bounteous news that you get online?
Do I pay for it? Well, I have an internet service provider.
But I mean, do you subscribe to any? Do you expect to ever pay for news again, to subscribe for news and pay a news producer again in your life?
No, actually, I feel that all media and video and all that stuff eventually, I mean, I pay by clicking on ads on websites and you know, using their ad services and things like that, just as I guess newspapers have their advertisers, and that's how they get paid. But no, I don't buy journals or newspapers or anything like that.
Gary, thanks for your call. Bill, there's an avid news consumer, but he doesn't think he ever will again. Is that your worst nightmare?
No, I think that represents a portion of the population that doesn't need all that much news. I mean, I do the same thing that Gary does. I start my day by skimming the headlines on a lot of different places, websites, mostly free websites, and that kind of gives my day a jump start. But I also there are subjects, even aside from my job, there are subjects that just interest me to the extent that I want to know more about them. I want to read them in depth. I want to know not just that today's headline says that there are divisions over the war in Afghanistan. I want to really understand whether the war in Afghanistan is going right or going wrong and what should be done about it. And you can't get that from a headline.
Will clicking on ads or just seeing banner ads be enough to pay for that kind of reporting for Gary and others long term?
Hard to say. I mean, we make a good deal of money from advertising on our website, a good deal of money. At this point, it would not be enough to support the size of newsroom that we've got. Could it conceivably grow to the extent that we could do that? Maybe, but not in the short run. At least that's not our estimation. So for now, it's a combination of revenues, circulation and advertising revenues from print, advertising revenues from the web, and beginning next year, some subscription revenue from the web.
Apple and Steve Jobs are getting into the middle of this in a big way. iPad is already seen as a good venue for news reading, news following, and Apple's reportedly going to start offering subscriptions where people can get news publications on the iPad. The thing is, they're going to own that relationship we're reading and take 30% of the subscription. Are you willing to join that system?
Well, fortunately, that's a decision that'll get made a little above my pay grade at the kind of publisher chief executive level of the company. What, you know, and lawyers will negotiate the terms of whatever arrangements we have with Apple and others. But I see the birth of the iPad as an extremely good sign for journalism, for serious journalism, both newspapers and magazines. I mean, I have an iPad. I already have an array of news sites, apps, and magazine apps, and I really like the ability to read in depth on a platform like that. I also still read print. I'm a kind of omnivorous news consumer. But I think the more options you offer people for getting beyond the headlines into the depth of the news, the better for us.
You think you're going to work for Apple?
I don't know. We may all be working for Steve Jobs someday.
Judy in Pittsfield, Massachusetts. Judy, you're on the air.
Hi, Mr. Carroll. It's a pleasure to have you on. I've been reading the New York Times, I think, since my early 20s. I grew up in New York, married and went to Rochester, New York, and we moved to Atlanta. Now we live in Cincinnati, although I'm here in Pittsfield. I cannot imagine living without the New York Times. I have picked it up online, but to try to read the Times online, I think it's very time-consuming and very hard on your back. To you can skim the headlines, but to look at all the columns and the news articles and then try to print it out, I mean, not print it out, but read it, is very difficult, I think, unless you're just skimming the news. And I enjoy my time so much reading it, and you can come back to it the next day, and you can clip articles, and you can send articles to people. And
but do you think it'll last, Judy? What about your kids or that generation?
My kids, my son reads it online. My daughter gets the Times. She gets the Sunday Times. And of course, there's nothing like getting the Sunday Times. I must tell Mr. Keller something, though. I've been reading the Times for a long time, and I find a lot of typos. Maybe it's the Cincinnati version of it, but a lot of typos, a lot of repeat things. I don't think it has the standards that it used to have.
Hire some more copy editors. But the resources, Judy, our time is getting short. Thanks for your call. One more. Colin in Brooklyn, New York. Colin, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to talk a little bit about, I guess, the younger generation and news. I think there is an interest in investigative reporting and sort of deeper look at the news. I think The Daily Show has picked that up in a big way, and I think it's been so popular because it deals with new media. But I also have a subscription to The New Yorker and Harper's, and I read those because they're smaller and they're weekly or biweekly and they're easy to read. I think that The New York Times, in terms of daily reporting, doesn't have much of a place anymore because it is, you know, no longer as instantaneous, at least the print edition. And I'm wondering, what do you see as the future, I guess? You know, are you going to go to the iPad? I think it is a good platform for newspapers because it can be multimedia. And, you know, the print edition is nice because it's nostalgic, but I'm wondering how realistic it is.
The print and also the sort of the focus in a period, Bill, where the instant news, the instant headlines are all over the place quickly. What does the Times offer that is the value add, it seems to me Colin's asking in a way?
Substance and depth.
Do you go further that way? Do you become more like the, I don't know, the New Yorker or Harper's or?
Well, we're not going to turn into a weekly magazine. We actually have a weekly magazine that's pretty good too. And we have a number of sections, weekly sections that are more magazine-like. So we do that kind of depth. But I mean, just, you know, in the daily news report, there is a difference between a paragraph or a headline or a few paragraphs on a story and a really well-reported story where one or more reporters have been out in the field, people who've had experience, or pieces that are the result of months of investigative work. Those you just can't get elsewhere, and we're publishing them every day.
That's your work way up in the food chain. What about down at the local level? A lot of local papers are in terrible trouble. If they go away, does it matter to a paper up in the high realms like the New York Times, or is there any way you can support that? You know, I mean, it's one thing to have a big national reporting organization, but what about all the cities and towns around the country who are seeing diminished reporting going on?
Well, it certainly matters to me as a citizen and as somebody who cares about this country that it's just as important that local school boards and planning commissions be held accountable as it is that the U.S. Congress and regulatory agencies and banks be held accountable. And when that goes away, it's a sad thing. We have tried some small scale experiments with what's called hyperlocal reporting on the web. A number of other places are sort of seeding local communities with mostly young, sometimes amateur reporters assigned to go cover local institutions. So far, it's a long way from replacing what's been lost in local communities. And you can only hope that will change.
Bill, what do you say to young people who think about journalism these days? Go into it or stay the heck away?
Absolutely go into it. Worst case scenario, if you learn the skills that it takes to be a good journalist, to gather, vet, organize, check, and communicate information, if there's some apocalypse and journalism disappears, those skills are transferable to an awful lot of other businesses.
There's a fallback position from a high position. Bill Keller, executive editor of the New York Times, we really appreciate your time today. Thank you so much for being with us, Bill, and good luck.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.